Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. As college students have returned to campuses around Illinois, you've maybe now heard about the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign's extensive testing program, also known as SHIELD. SHIELD was designed to target, test, and tell U of I students and staff. Tests are mandatory twice a week. And to give you a sense of how many tests that is, the University of Illinois' approximately 10,000 tests conducted per day account for 1-2% of all daily testing in the United States. I'm going to say that again. They're doing about 10,000 tests a day, and that's 1-2% of all of the COVID testing every day in the United States. The university's test has received FDA emergency authorization, and Governor J.B. Pritzker has expressed his hope that the test can eventually be expanded to a statewide level. Some are even saying it could be a nationwide model. Joining us now to talk about the SHIELD program and the state of testing are Christine Herman, who's a health reporter for Illinois Newsroom, WILL, and Side Effects Public Media. Hello, Christine. Welcome back to the 21st.
Thanks, Brian.
We're also joined by Paul Hergenrother, professor of chemistry at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign and the lead developer of U of I's rapid saliva COVID-19 test. Hello, Paul, and welcome to the 21st to you as well.
Hi, Brian. Great to be here.
Also with us is Becky Smith, associate professor of pathobiology, if I'm saying that right, at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. She's also, as I understand, an epidemiologist. Hello, Becky. Welcome back to the 21st to you as well.
Hi, Brian. Great to be here.
And we also have Susan Butler Wu. She's the director of Clinical Microbiology Laboratory at the University of Southern California. Hello, Susan. Thanks for joining us today on the 21st.
Thank you for having me.
And listeners, as I said before the break, we want to invite you to join our conversation. Our lines are open. The number to call is 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. If you have any questions about COVID testing, about the U of I's test in particular, or just testing more broadly, give us a call, 800-222-9455. You can also always tweet us at 21st Show. Christine, I just want to start with sort of a baseline. Where is U of I with testing right now? How's it going?
Yes, so as you mentioned in the intro, the U of I has been running about 10,000 tests per day on average in the past week. So far, more than 100,000 tests since August 16th, which is when students began arriving back in mass on campus, and that's when twice a week testing became mandatory for students and employees. As of last Thursday, which is the most recent data that's on the public database that the U of I has been updating, there are 564 total COVID-19 cases identified among students and employees. And the database was just updated to report unique cases of COVID. So these are 564 unique cases in roughly the past 2 weeks. So, and just as a point of comparison, as you know, you were talking to other Illinois campuses in the previous segment, but at the U of I, 75% of classes are entirely online. The remainder are in person or have some portion of class in person.
Yeah, and just as that point of comparison, we heard at Illinois State University, which is one of the other very large public universities in Illinois, that they've run about 4,400 tests this semester. U of I, as you said, more than 100,000 tests at this point this semester. But Becky, I want to ask you, as part of the SHIELD program, you were instrumental in determining how much and who to test, how much to test and who to test. The U of I is doing this twice weekly testing on a scale unlike many other college campuses. So there are a lot of people looking at the program. I wonder, from the data we just heard, what you're seeing so far, do you think it's working?
So the data we have so far is actually mostly covering the return of students to campus. And in that case, we are seeing about what we expected and about what we predicted, that the number of students returning to campus infected is about what we expected it to be. What we're starting to see now with these last few days of testing will be the spread that we see on campus. So it's actually still a little too early to say how well we are containing spread on campus, because we're only just starting to see those numbers, simply because it takes a few days to go from infection to being detectable by test. And then a few days after that, for any secondary cases after that first case. So there is a delay in detecting spread. So I'm hopeful. I'm going to be watching the numbers pretty closely in the next week. But really, this week, we find out what happened last week.
Interesting. So, yeah, that's a good way to say it. This week, we find out what happened last week, because it's, there is some delay in the testing. And I guess that's notable, even because this test is so much faster than you see in the sort of nasopharyngeal swab testing that's been so common throughout this, where we're seeing private labs sometimes take a week, or in some cases even more than a week, to get results back. You know, Paul Hergenrother, I want to bring you in now. You led the team of developers of this test at U of I. Can you talk about the genesis? How did this come about?
Yeah, I think, Becky Smith and others, Nigel Goldenfeld, really taught us that frequent repeat testing is the key. And it became apparent pretty quickly that one would not be able to do that with a swab test, for a lot of reasons on the kind of scale that we want to do here at the University of Illinois with all of our students, faculty, and staff. Just the availability of those materials and just the invasive nature of especially the NP swab. And so pretty early on, we recognized we needed to use something different, and saliva made a lot of sense to us as we are all wearing masks for the reason that particles and droplets and aerosols out of our mouths are the predominant cause for the spread of this disease. And so testing the infectious media, the media responsible for most infections, really made a lot of sense to us. And then obviously saliva is a lot easier to give and is compatible with, twice weekly testing.
And just the simple fact of not having to have someone stick a glorified Q-tip up your nose is right. Makes it a lot easier for people. So as a chemist, and I will say, I think I'm the only non-PhD on this panel of people today. So can you say in simple terms, for those of us who take one, we walk in, give our information, spit in a tube, leave the tube in a tray. We get an email with the results. You know, what is happening in between the email and leaving our saliva in a tube?
Yeah. So we tell people to drool, not spit. That's one thing.
Good to know. I'll make a note of that.
So actually, the test is still an RT-PCR test. So the back end of it is very, very similar to the what happens with the standard swab test. Instead of checking by RT-PCR a swab, we are simply checking the saliva. So in that way, we feel really good about the test. So the key and the key to the fast turnaround was building our own diagnostic lab here on campus. So when people drill into a tube, there's 40 collection stations on campus. Every hour on the hour, there's a driver that picks up the tubes from those sites and brings them down to the lab. And so, and then the lab starts processing them. So there's no mailing them off. There's no out of state lab or anything like that. It's the lab is literally 5 minutes away and starts getting processed. There's it's a Herculean effort down there. I will say, the two people that really in the lab developed the test, Dr. Diana Renoa and Dr. Robin Holland, have continued to lead the effort of implementing this test. It's one thing to develop it, then to implement it now on, Monday we did 17,000 tests. So the lab is working 3 8-hour shifts. So it's literally a 24-hour a day operation.
And Susan Butler Wu, you are the director of the Clinical Microbiology Laboratory at the University of Southern California. One of the reasons I wanted to ask you to join this conversation, you were quoted in the New York Times a few weeks ago talking about early on you were all for PCR testing. This is polymerase chain reaction testing. And I want to talk a little bit later about how some epidemiologists and others are maybe shifting their view on whether PCR is the testing we should be used. But can you talk a little bit, from a sort of global perspective, why was PCR viewed as so important to our, getting a handle on the COVID-19 pandemic from the beginning?
Yeah, so PCR is essentially the gold standard way now for diagnostic testing to detect the presence of virus. So it really is the most sensitive test. So in terms of trying to, and I should say, my focus is I direct a clinical lab in a hospital. So my focus is absolutely to make sure that I'm not missing the detection of the virus in patients that are coming into our hospital. So the main problem that's happened in the States, and you could have a whole separate show about this, but because we don't have a nationalized healthcare system and we don't have a nationalized coordinated response, essentially you have what I refer to as like diagnostic deserts, basically people that have no access to testing. So you can see how successful the University of Illinois program is, because basically you have a lab right there and people can get quick turnaround times. The bottom line is we have many, many hospitals and doctor's offices and healthcare systems that don't have access to the same kind of resources. So really talking about using non-PCR-based testing essentially as a way to try and at least have some access to testing, in my mind, than to places that can't readily access PCR. Because as you noted, you know, some private labs are taking more than a week. That was because they're just getting too many tests for what they can handle. And that sort of a turnaround time is not clinically useful whatsoever. And it's not useful at stopping spread. There is, as you mentioned, a viewpoint that maybe we shouldn't be doing PCR or that antigen testing may be more indicative of infectivity. I personally don't think there are really data to support that, but I view it more as a way to at least provide some sort of testing to settings where they may not have access.
Okay. And I want to go to the phones now. We have a caller, Barb in Springfield. And you have a question about how this test works. Welcome to the 21st, and please go ahead.
Hi, Brian. Thank you. As I'm listening to this PCR versus antigen, it kind of refines my question. The PCR test, is that testing active? And you may have answered this while I was calling in, but is it an active virus? Is it testing antibodies? What's the difference between PCR and antigen? And just a side question, so are the samples, I assume the samples that are taken on the Springfield campus are being sent to Champaign then and tested in your lab there?
I'm going to direct that question to Paul. Barb, thank you for the call. Yeah. Go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, thanks, Barb, for the question. To answer the second question, yes, the UIS samples are being evaluated in our lab. PCR and antigen are both looking for material in the virus. So PCR test is looking at the genetic material, so the RNA, and then it's reverse transcribed to DNA, then amplified. The antigen test is looking more at the proteins. So they're both looking at the virus. Now, live virus is different than non-infectious virus. And so that can be a function more of where you're sampling from. It's been documented pretty well by the CDC that, for example, the nasal swab can be positive. There's patients that are positive for months, literally. And the CDC has recommended those people be released from isolation after 10 days because what is being identified and amplified is simply a dead virus.
Yeah, and that's one of the issues here is that there's this dichotomy, I guess, between being able to detect any amount of virus and the actual window in which people are infectious, right? Which is a lot smaller.
Yeah, I think so. Yep.
Okay. Can I just
add something, Brian?
Please.
I think it's important for the listeners to understand this. That antigen testing for other respiratory viruses has been notoriously tricky. And I don't think we fully understand the performance of antigen testing for either diagnosis or for detecting infectivity at this point. There's been what we refer to as pseudo outbreaks on the East Coast. These are cases where people have positive antigen results, but it turns out that they really are negative. So I think that we have to just be, you know, it's difficult for the public because there's so many different tests they're hearing about. And I totally understand. I mean, my joke, my husband is you kind of need a PhD in clinical diagnostics to keep track of all this. But I do think it's important for people to understand with respect to antigen testing, we don't fully understand how well it's performing at this point.
Yeah. So thank you for that, Susan. And I want to ask, Paul, do we have a sense of how accurate this test is? The U of I test, I should say, is.
Yeah, again, because we're doing PCR, that has been very well understood. And the specific version of that is the Thermo Fisher primer set. So we basically are amplifying three genes for the virus. So And that's been kind of looked at up and down by many others. So as was mentioned with PCR, you have a pretty good idea of accuracy. I think antigen tests, as mentioned, would be great. And I would love to be able to switch to those. Those can be point of care, truly, where you get a result back in 15 minutes or perhaps obviate the need for a centralized lab and this massive effort we've made here. I think as the accuracy of those improves, then that will really, really be great.
And Becky, we need to take a break in just a couple of minutes here, but as an epidemiologist, I mean, as I understand it, the false negative rate is potentially 11%, right? So let me make sure I'm saying that right. You know, you could be missing 11% of, you know, if you process 10,000 tests, there are possibly more than 1,000 results that might be missed. I mean, do I understand that right? And does that worry you? Hello, podcast and web listeners. Brian Mackey here. I'm interrupting today's show because, in fact, I did not understand that right. I said it incorrectly. So the math works like this. If you have the 11% false negative rate, which is what the University of Illinois has said according to its own preliminary studies, if you were to do 10,000 tests in a place that had an infection rate of about 1%, you would only have 100 people infected. Therefore, the universe in which 11% of people would get a false negative result would in fact be 11 people, not 1,000 people. So I accidentally drastically overstated that amount. Now, with that correction in mind, let's pick up right where we left off.
So as an epidemiologist, I have to say it depends. So the false negative rate is going to depend on where you are in the infection. Very early in the infection, we might be more likely to miss you. But if you have a test that you can give frequently, so every 3 to 4 days, as we're doing, we'll get you on the next test. That's the idea of frequent testing, is that if the false negative rate is a bit higher, doing 2 tests a week means that we're more likely to find you while you're still infectious. With the antigen tests, I'm more worried about the false positive rate, but that means that antigen tests combined with PCRs are very helpful, that if you test positive on an antigen test, you can follow it up with a PCR.
So you can have the sort of blunt test to begin with and then follow up with a more precise test later on if needed. Okay, well, this has been an interesting conversation. We're going to continue it. We do need to take a quick break, though. We have been speaking with Becky Smith, who is a professor at the University of Illinois, an epidemiologist, and a professor of pathobiology. Also, Paul Hergenrother, who's a chemistry professor at the U of I, helped develop the rapid saliva COVID-19 test. Susan Butler-Wu is director of the Clinical Microbiology Laboratory at USC, and also Christine Herman, health reporter for Illinois Newsroom, WILL. If I can ask you all to just hang on, and we have a couple of callers on the line with some good questions. Stick around as well. We need to take a quick break. More to come. This is The 21st. Welcome back to The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We're taking a deep dive on testing, and specifically the U of I's saliva-based SHIELD testing program. They're testing as many as 10,000 tests a day. It's accounting for a statistically significant share of all daily U.S. COVID testing. We're speaking with reporter Christine Herman, chemist Paul Hergenrother of the U of I, Becky Smith, an epidemiologist at the U of I, and Susan Butler-Wu, who is a microbiologist and director of the Clinical Microbiology Laboratory at USC in California, for a sort of national perspective on this. So I want to begin. We have another call, and I should say, listeners, you're always welcome to join our conversations. 800-222-9455. The number again is 800-222-9455. We heard Governor Governor Pritzker has been very, Governor J.B. Pritzker of Illinois has been very excited about the U of I test and has been talking about the possibilities of scaling it. And that sort of dovetails with one of our callers, Mike in Peoria. Welcome to the 21st. What is your question?
Well, thank you for taking my call. And my question is the affordability of the test, assuming that it pans out as very effective. Are there plans of sharing this with health agencies throughout the state and maybe throughout the country as well as universities?
Okay, thank you for that call. Sounds like you're in the wind there, Mike. But Paul Hergenrother, I wonder, how scalable do you anticipate this test might be?
Yeah, sure. Thanks, Mike, for the question. Yeah, one of the interesting things about this test is it's simply a protocol. There's no test kits. There are things that any lab can buy. We put our manuscript out in mid-June, in fact, to facilitate the adoption by other agencies, hospitals, institutions, et cetera. We've worked with 3 or 4 dozen different universities to try to stand up similar testing on their campus. So there's no proprietary reagent or something like that that we're making. I think within the state of Illinois is where you'll see the fastest progress on this. There is a Shield Illinois that is being stood up. And in fact, Mike in Peoria is a plan for one of them. There's going to be 10 of these saliva testing sites throughout the state at different locations. And then there are also a plan for a mobile version of it. So the first truck with this lab on it is supposed to roll out by the end of September. And then there'll be, I think, 4 others after that. So yes, the short answer is there's plans to deploy, but others can adopt it if they would like, because the protocol is all out there.
And Christine, what does this cost? Can you talk about the how much this costs the U of I and what projections might be for outside that?
Yeah, on a recent press call, Provost Andreas Congalera said that they invested $6 million up front to launch the SHIELD program, including all of the testing. And given that it costs about $10 per test, and at the scale they're running the tests, it costs an extra $10 million to execute this high level of testing for this semester. So and one thing I would add just to answer Mike's question, Peoria, I know that, and as an example, our partner station WGLT is just reporting that ISU is one of those campuses in Illinois that is now working on building up lab capacity to ramp up testing at Illinois State University. My understanding is there are some hurdles there with acquiring the testing machines and other supplies, which are all in high demand nationwide around the world right now and are difficult to get. So I know that they're projecting maybe 8 to 10 weeks before they can do perhaps a similar level of testing that the U of I is doing there on that campus. And it requires that the lab be certified. It's called CLIA certification. It's CLIA, but basically it's a medical diagnostic lab. And I understand that at ISU, the challenge is ramping up the capacity because they have a certified diagnostic lab, but they need to increase staffing as well as increase their ability to churn through this many tests this quickly. And that's a pretty big logistical hurdle.
And Susan Butler, I want to ask, do you see the future of COVID testing around the country being in something that is PCR based? Or, I've been following the work of Michael Mina at Harvard, who's been calling for almost like a home pregnancy test type kit, which just like it would be a paper strip. It could cost $1 or $5. Everybody would get their monthly supply. I wonder, do you support that concept? Do you think that we just need to try everything and everything, or where are we on this?
I think that we all have to just face up to the reality that we cannot test our way out of this mess, neither with what Dr. Mina is proposing nor otherwise. And I think, I can't remember which one of the panelists said that we know this week what happened last week. And I think that's a really important point. In terms of the cost of all of this, it was just mentioned this costs $10. It does not cost $10 because when you have a CLIA certified lab, it has to be done by medical laboratory scientists. And there's a lot of, keep the lights on and you have to, do proficiency testing and all these things that actually make the cost much more. I think none of this is a replacement for having a strategy. And what I'm very concerned about with the concept of daily testing is there's absolutely no evidence to say that you can have a test and just carry on as normal. particularly right. because of the natural biology of the virus. As was mentioned, we know this week what happened last week. So I'm not sure that it's a panacea as it's been sort of purported. I'm very concerned about the human factor here, that people are going to have a home test themselves, decide it's negative, and engage in risky behavior. Testing is essentially part of a strategy, but it's not a standalone strategy in and of itself. There is no replacement, sadly, for masking or for distancing or for good hand hygiene. And while I think, you know, it's gotten a lot of attention, this in-home testing that you can do, I don't think there's any data at this point to support using that as the approach to tackle this pandemic, sadly.
You know, I'm so glad you mentioned that sort of psychological factor. And Becky, I wanted to ask you about this as a member of the SHIELD team and an epidemiologist. I mean, community members around the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, communities do not have access to the rapid and testing unless they are employed by or enrolled at the U of I. And, you know, this idea of testing twice per week is to try and capture as much as it can. But I mean, that's still a long time between tests. One of our producers was talking to a grocery store worker who was shared that a U of I student came through the line, had a mask, but maybe didn't have it over their mouth and were eating a bag of chips as they were going through the grocery store line. And the grocery store worker said, "Can you please put your mask back on?" And this student pulled out their phone and showed, "Oh, look, I've been, you know, passed for the, you know, green status or I guess it's yellow technically, that shows that you have not, you know, you did not have a positive COVID-19 test in the last X number of days." I mean, do you think there is this false sense of security out there and sort of a free pass on engaging in high risk activities among some students?
That is definitely something that we have really worried about, Brian, and we have always stressed that it is absolutely essential to not rely solely on the testing, because as Susan said, you cannot test yourself out of this. We have to have the masks, we have to have the social distancing, we have to comply with contact tracers and quarantine orders. Just knowing your test status is not enough. It has to be all the things together. The good news is that if they're all combined, they work synergistically, meaning the whole is greater than the sum of the parts. But if you only do the testing and nothing else, it will fail. We have to have the masks and we have to have all of the public health regulations in place, and people have to abide by those. And yes, we do worry about a false sense of security with the testing. And that's one of my biggest concerns with at-home antigen testing, is that people will have that sense of security and may engage in riskier behaviors because they think, "Well, I'm test negative, I'm okay." That's not going to be enough.
Okay. And listeners, we have another call at 800-222-9455. Marty in Champaign, welcome to the 21st. Go ahead with your question. Hello, Marty. Are you there? Okay, we seem to have lost our caller. With it, I can paraphrase. This person was wondering, you know, if, you know, a positive test, maybe if somebody has a positive test, they get released in 10 days. But if somebody was exposed, they're quarantined for 14. I don't know who would want to take, why there's that difference. And also, I wonder if something I've been reading about is that, you know, we have this idea of you could be infectious for up to 14 days. But as I understand it, the peak infectiousness is a much shorter window of time. I don't know if Becky, you want to address these differences in how the response to COVID is handled?
Sure. And some of this is we're learning as we go.
Sure.
The science
sure.
is always changing. We do know that, yes, as you say, peak infectiousness happens just a couple of days after we can first detect you by testing. Just 4 to 5 days after infection is when you peak with infectiousness, and infectiousness does drop off. And in one study, they found that among asymptomatic people, there was no active virus after 9 days, which is why the guidelines are for isolation, that after 10 days, you can be released from isolation because you should no longer be infectious. With quarantine, we know that there have been long delays in time to symptoms. And so the quarantine guidelines were originally designed for symptomatic screening, saying, we're going to put you in quarantine and see if you get sick. With our screening tests, that might not be quite as important, but because it's the best practices, we always want to follow the best practices. We are sticking to that 14 days of quarantine just in case it takes you longer to become noticeably infectious. Now, locally, if you are in quarantine and you're a member of the campus community, you're asked to come test at day 5. That doesn't mean you get released if you're negative. That's just so that if you are positive, we can then know that you should be in isolation rather than quarantine. But we're still learning as much as we can, as quickly as we can, but there's a lot still to learn about the dynamics of the virus.
Yeah. And Susan, I wanted to ask you, there's also been a lot of attention, especially in Illinois, on the Abbott rapid test. As I understand it, it's a $5 test. It's something that can be done pretty much anywhere. Abbott is, of course, an Illinois company. Can you talk a little bit about how that works, you know, an antigen test versus the PCR test and how, you know, effective and how they compare?
Sure. So I think as was mentioned earlier, the antigen test essentially looks for the protein. So I think everybody's seen the little pictures of what COVID looks like and all the spiky business that's around it. Basically, that entire outside is the protein. There's different proteins in that structure. And the RNA is what's inside the virus, right? That's its nucleic acid. So the antigen testing is looking at protein. Different tests look at different proteins. And so the principle is that you would have, that test has emergency use authorization for a nasal swab. And so you would have a nasal swab and you basically extract the protein and you detect it with what we refer to as a lateral flow device. So it looks kind of like a pregnancy test. So some of the, what we know from the literature is that people with the highest viral load tend to be antigen positive. But what we don't know, there's a lot that we don't know. We don't actually know how well this works on asymptomatic patients at all. Basically in emergency use authorization, they looked at patients that were symptomatic. So that's important. Historically for antigen testing for respiratory viruses, they have issues not only with false positivity, which I mentioned earlier on, but also with false negatives also. So I think, you know, when this came out, and it got emergency use authorization, there was a lot of excitement because, you know, it's the first antigen test that doesn't need a specialized instrument or machine to read it. Your eyes can read it, but it still is required to be done in a medical office or anywhere that has a CLIA waiver. I think it has the potential, again, I view this more as a tool in the toolbox. I would personally be very uncomfortable with relying on an antigen test if we were admitting patients into hospital or anything of that nature. So I think all of these things have their place. I think they're often sort of overhyped as like, quote unquote, game changer. I think we're in the field, we're all kind of tired of the word game changer. I think it has the potential to be a useful tool, but we have to be careful because we don't fully understand its performance.
Well, I'm sure we will have many more conversations about COVID-19 testing in the weeks and months and, heaven help us, possibly the years ahead. I want to thank Dr. Susan Butler-Wu, who's director of the Clinical Microbiology Laboratory at the University of Southern California, Dr. Paul Hergenrother, who's professor of chemistry at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and was lead developer of the rapid saliva COVID-19 test. Also, Becky Smith, epidemiologist at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, and Christine Herman, who's a health reporter for Illinois Newsroom, WILL, and Side Effects Public Media. Thank you all so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And all we have time is to say the 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey, and we will talk to you tomorrow.